Hello, it's Tuesday, June the 15th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up in the programme, we're talking about weddings. Oh well, the restrictions have finally been lifted, but most wedding organisers are still pretty much in the dark. GB News, have you watched it? It's the one with Andrew Neil. Jan Moore has, and her review, it's absolutely hilarious. We're talking also about unemployment. It's gone down for a fourth month. Is this a good sign that we're coming out of the COVID-induced recession? The first poll since we were told that lockdown measures are not going to be lifted on June the 21st. Only 23% of people blame the Prime Minister. But first, that woman, Shamima Begum, the jihadi bride, she's given an interview which we've carried in the mail in her refugee camp. She made one mistake when she was a silly 15-year-old girl. Should she be allowed back in Britain? I certainly hope not. Shamima Begum, the so-called jihadi bride, says she was just a dumb kid when she left the UK to join ISIS as a 15-year-old, and she's begging to be allowed home. The 21-year-old now, former British schoolgirl, was speaking during an interview with the media at a refugee camp in Syria, where she remains stripped of her British citizenship. The question we're asking is, can she be de-radicalised? Mesa Gifford fought against ISIS in Syria, and he's the author of Fighting Evil, a book about his experiences, and he joins me now. Will be a great hue and cry from many people on the left, Mesa, maybe even some people on the right, that she was just a child and should come back, and that we should forgive her.
Well, she's no longer a child. She's 21 years old. Yes, she was underage. She was 15 when she committed her first crime in joining the so-called Islamic State. But then again, she was above the age of criminal responsibility. And far more importantly, and this is the thing that bothers, I think, the vast majority of the British public, is that she was 5 years in the Islamic State. She's experienced a huge amount of training, ideological training. She's shown very little remorse for her actions and her time spent in Syria. And actually, she only left Syria after the final battle in Barghouz. She basically went through months, years of being pushed back by the SDF, the local forces, the forces that I fought with, until the very last battle, and then she surrendered. So she's actually proved herself over the years to be a very committed member of the Islamic State, and one that only reluctantly surrendered.
And yet she says in this interview with Andrew Drury, which we reported in the Mail today, I don't think I was a terrorist. I think I was just a dumb kid who made one mistake. Hard to say 5 years with IS, producing three children along the way with an IS warrior, is just one mistake.
No, and there's very serious accusations against her from local people. And that's what I find so frustrating here. People want to pluck her out of Syria, bring her back to the UK, and presumably release her after a year, possibly two, in detention in the UK, even if she gets to court, that is. But what we're doing is we're denying local people justice. The true victims here are the thousands of Yazidi girls, some as young as 3 years old, that are sold into sexual slavery. And Shamima Begum was one of about 1,000 British people that joined ISIS. And I think it would show us in the most incredibly poor light as a country if we were to deny local people justice and simply, invite her back to very little blame and punishment, really.
And one of the allegations against her was that she sewed suicide bombers into their suicide vests before they were dispatched to go and wreak havoc and chaos. That's a pretty serious charge against her.
Yes, well, and she was also accused of being in the Hizbah, which is the religious police. The women, far from being innocent victims of ISIS, people who were lured from Britain, actually proved themselves to be some of the most hardcore supporters of ISIS. They were the most feared by local people and by Yazidi girls. And if you were to listen to community leaders in Syria, they're all saying the same thing. Why is Shamima Begum in a refugee camp in Syria living in much better conditions than us, the real victims of ISIS? Why is the British public talking about rescuing Shamima Begum, calling her a victim and wanting to bring her back to the UK when we're still missing something like 4,000 young girls? We're still digging up tens of thousands of people from mass graves all across Syria and Iraq. Yet this is what's dominating the conversation at the moment. And let's not forget that Shamima is just the tip of the iceberg. There are dozens of other British people waiting to come back. They're watching the Shamima case very closely because there's excuses that could be made for all of them. Some of them had mental health issues. Some of them were also very young when they went out to join. But the point is, unless we put them through a justice system, unless we treat them not as victims, but as dangerous terrorists, we are in real danger of getting this wrong. And I think we should be putting the British public first on this one, really.
And if I could ask you just finally, mate, so you don't need me to remind you that the London Bridge terrorist, the murderer who killed two people, he'd served some time in prison, Usman Khan, he was actually at a course on rehabilitation when he struck and killed two people working for a charity who were trying to help him. He'd not been rehabilitated at all. He'd completely conned the authorities. Shamima Begum presumably could do exactly the same.
Well, the system is weak. The system doesn't always protect the British public. Another case would be the young man that came back from Libya and committed a terrible atrocity in Manchester. He was allowed to slip through the net. And what do we owe Shamima Begum? What do we owe anyone that's got ripped up their passport and declared war against Britain and our friends abroad? These people went to Syria to kill and to murder. And if we're so naive to simply think that just because Shamima Begum discards her burqa and then starts saying that she misses the UK and wants to get back into KFC and resume her normal life, if we're to take her on face value and just allow her in, who's going to take the responsibility if we allow in the wrong person? And that's the point. Unless we get this right, it could backfire terribly.
And just a final thought. Who'd want that woman living next door to them? Perhaps the bleeding heart liberals who are saying she should come back should have a move in next door, because I wouldn't want her name in my street.
Yeah, and you wouldn't want, it makes you think twice when you put your kids on the bus to school or if you take them to a rock concert. What you don't want on your mind is the dozens of people who are committed terrorists who have spent years abroad potentially coming back to the UK. It's about time we thought of them first before we thought about terrorists who've made their decisions, who made their beds, and as far as I'm concerned, should be lying in them.
Absolutely right. That's Mesa Gifford, who fought against ISIS in Syria and is the author of Fighting Evil, a book about his experiences. Thanks for joining me. So visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So the waiting's finally over and we now know the current COVID restrictions are going to remain in place until July the 19th, 4 weeks beyond the originally planned Freedom Day of June 21st. Michael Gove, the Cabinet Office Minister, said today that they will definitely reach that target. But I think that's what the Prime Minister said about June the 21st. Some Tory MPs and people working in the entertainment, travel and hospitality sectors have criticised the delay. But a new poll finds that 2 in 5 people actually believe restrictions should continue after the July 19 deadline. Chris Hopkins is Associate Director of Savannah Comres, who ran that poll, and he joins me now. That's pretty amazing, Chris, isn't it? That many people think, actually, the lockdown should go on longer. Were you surprised by that? Because I was.
Yeah, a little bit. I think the context of those numbers, Andrew, is that when we ask people what's important to be considered when thinking about lifting restrictions, the top three things are obviously going to be cases, followed by hospitalizations and death. And I think what we're likely to see probably over the next 4 weeks is that those will probably still continue to rise. And I think that is going to give the Prime Minister a bit of a headache in the next fortnight or 4 weeks when he's trying to commit to his new date of July the 19th. Because I think there's going to be, I think the government is going to have to do quite a lot of explaining about why, even though cases are rising and hospitalizations and deaths might still be rising a little bit, why it's okay to open up. And obviously that should in theory be down to continued vaccine rollout and lots more people getting their second jab. But I do get the impression potentially from this data that might be the reason why the public seem to still be in theory, are favouring a more cautious approach than even the government, who are criticised for being overly cautious.
Yeah, and what I found also fascinating, Chris, only 23% say the government is most to blame for the delay. Now, the Labour Party today are making big on calling the Indian variant or the Delta variant. They're trying to call it the Johnson variant because they're trying to make the delay in putting India on the red list stick. But they've got a lot of work to do, judging from your poll, if less than a quarter of people are blaming the government.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if this is just not you know, the Labour message not cutting through, which, as we've spoken about many times, isn't just in terms of the coronavirus response that Labour aren't really having much of an impact among the public. But yeah, I have to say, I think that that finding did surprise me. I mean, I still think, again, there was a public impression that coronavirus is uncontrollable, and the government, and the only way to really combat it is with the vaccine, and therefore, you know, everything the government says regarding the vaccine is believed. And then, you know, when things are pushed back, when restrictions are pushed back, and obviously the unlockdown delay occurs, as it has done, then the public is still willing to give the government a bit of a free pass over it, not really consider perhaps why those cases are rising, and as Labour are saying, whether that's down to the government refusing to shut borders or not. I guess that can be debated, but it doesn't appear, at least from a sort of large swathe of the public, that they're really marrying up the two, and the government are kind of getting away with it again.
Yeah, and I guess also, Chris, but they know, they see on the TV, they listen on the radio, they read in the papers, still shocking problems going on in India, all around the world. COVID is still a big issue. I mean, France has only just started lifting its 6:30 p.m. curfew. So, and I suppose also a lot of people think we've had a lot of measures lifted from lockdown. We can go about our lives much more normally now. And the sun is shining. And I always think that's a positive when these polls are taken.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, the fieldwork from this one was conducted yesterday. It was a pretty nice day, and so yeah, maybe we caught people in a good mood. But you know, I do think that you are right in that. I think that the sectors that are still being drastically affected by the restrictions aren't ones that the public have as much care for. Being completely brutally honest, I'm sure there are many people that want to go back to theatres and want to go back to nightclubs, but there may not be loads of those in our 1,000 sample poll, because as a proportion of the population, it's not huge. I do think that the public will continue to have sympathy for those businesses and those sectors that are struggling. But I think that throughout the pandemic, all the public have really cared about, or what they've cared about above anything else, is lower case numbers, which means lower hospitalizations, which means lower numbers of people dying from coronavirus. And as far as the public is concerned, they're happy to continue with restrictions if it means that those things go down.
That's Chris Hopkins. He's Associate Director of Savanta Comres, which carried out that survey. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at mailplus or me at Toryboypierce. So one of the bright spots from the Prime Minister's Downing Street briefing yesterday was that restrictions on weddings are to be relaxed after all from June 21st. Those planning to get married between then and July 19th, which is the next Freedom Day, will no longer have to abide by the 30-person cap on guests, but social distancing rules will still apply. Singing and dancing indoors is still banned. What impact is this going to have on the wedding industry? Sarah Allard is the site editor for wedding planning destination Hitched. Sarah, you must be pleased, as far as it's gone, that people can at least have a wedding now and potentially maybe have 70 or 100 guests, but still restrictions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's certainly a positive step for the industry. And I mean, having that, that specific mention from Boris in the address was a really positive step. But I think it's also been met with quite a lot of confusion still. I mean, his update wasn't particularly clear cut. And now that we've had the guidelines, there's still quite a few things that couples can't do, which they would obviously want to do in their wedding. So it's still going to be a bit of a struggle, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and so, and I gather you can, the first dance is still permissible indoors, but no more dances. And you when you design the reception or the wedding breakfast, whatever you call it, it's still going to be six people per table, and the tables will have to be socially distanced as well.
Yeah, that's right. So they've said that dancing is advised against. They have said that, you know, dance floors should remain closed. We've seen some quite funny posts on our Instagram about people dancing to the toilets instead and, you know, trying to get around the restrictions. But, you know, it's really difficult. I think a lot of people, you know, couples can now, you know, potentially go ahead with their day, and they might be able to have, you know, up to 100 people depending on the size of their venue. But, you know, dancing might be a really important part to them. And so it's very difficult. You know, they might be able to go ahead, but there could be some of these elements that they still can't have, and that's really, that's such a shame, because that's, you know, really an important part of their day.
Catastrophic an effect has it been on the wedding industry, the rules that have been in place since the first lockdown, Sarah? Because it is a big industry, isn't it? Lots of jobs depend on it. I'm thinking of photographers and florists and the people who drive the bride and groom to and from the church or the wedding venue, and then there's all the work the caterers have lost too.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's a huge industry, and I think, you know, ever since March last year, the guidelines for the industry just haven't been as clear-cut or considered as they have in other sectors. And when you consider that many venues haven't been able to operate, but they haven't been able to technically, or they haven't had to technically close either. So therefore, they haven't been able to claim any support from the government. And we've just been kind of left in the dark, to be honest. You know, the guidelines, every time we've had an announcement from Boris Johnson, the guidelines have taken a few days to update. So, you know, even though we have that initial, you know, that update from the Prime Minister about things that can happen, it takes a long time for those guidelines about what a wedding will actually look like to come through. So then you have panicked couples, and you have, you know, people going to their venue and their suppliers. Everyone's trying to figure out what these, you know, what these guidelines mean. And I think that's been the biggest, you know, one of the biggest challenges, really. It's just the kind of the lack of guidance and the disparity with other sectors as well. Certainly now, I think, you know, it's so great that we've, you know, had this acknowledgement, and there is going to be a potential increase in numbers, but, you know, compared to all the other sectors, I think that it still feels quite unfair.
Yeah, and the Wimbledon tennis final, Centre Court, it's going to be full capacity, apparently. Oh, yes, the Prime Minister likes tennis, doesn't he? He plays tennis at Chequers all the time. And yet you've got all sorts of restrictions still in place on weddings. And, of course, the Prime Minister knows all about this, Sarah, because he just got married himself.
Absolutely, yeah. I think very wise of him probably to have a very, very small wedding, as we know that he did. And I think reports are that he's planning to have a bigger party next year. But yeah, you know, it's something that a lot of couples are now, you know, experiencing. And, you know, over the next 4 weeks, I think it's going to be, it's great news, but also it's been, yeah, as I said, lots of confusion. And I think today is going to be, I really feel for all the venues and suppliers that are having to kind of chat to all of their couples and the couples as well, of course, having to figure out between them, you know, what are the numbers going to be dependent on the capacity of that particular venue that they've booked, and figure out, okay, what are the numbers now? What can we do? What can't we do? And just trying to figure out a plan for any of those couples that are getting married in the next 4 weeks. I mean, the UK Wedding Task Force estimates that approximately 12,500 couples marry every week. So that's going to be a huge amount of people that are going to be impacted by this.
Yeah, I just thought about this as well. Finally, Sarah, couples often, when they have that, go on their honeymoon, they like to go somewhere exotic and somewhere hot. Well, that's not going to happen either, is it, in the next few weeks? Because the green list, probably, unless they want to go on honeymoon to the Falkland Islands, there's not many places on the green list where they can go.
Absolutely. And also, good luck trying to book anywhere, even in Cornwall, as I've been trying to do. It's an absolute nightmare. I mean, obviously, everywhere's just booked up in the UK now as well. So, yeah, it's not easy. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's still lots of places in the UK that people can book, but, you know, places are booking up because it's just been so difficult to get abroad, as you said.
That's Sarah Allard, she's the site editor for the wedding planning destination Hitched. Thanks for joining us. So it's that time in the programme when we talk about what's happening in the Square Mile. Hugo Duncan is, of course, the Deputy Business Editor of the Daily Mail. Hugo, we clutch at good news when we get it. Pretty good news coming out on the unemployment figures.
That's right, Andrew. There's actually last month there was a record rise in the number of people in work. It rose by 197,000 in May. And of course, this was the month when we started to really get our freedoms back after the May the 17th lifting of further lockdown restrictions. Not only that, it's been rising for 6 months in a row. And the unemployment rate itself has fallen to 4.7%, which, given we have been through the worst recession for over 300 years, is quite a dramatic number. The big issue, of course, facing the economy is what comes next. And the news yesterday that the end of lockdown was going to be delayed for a further 4 weeks is causing some concern.
And is that because, it means furlough will end, Hugo, and there's pressure for the Chancellor to continue with it. And of course, it's also going to hit the hospitality, the entertainment industry, theatres, all very, very hard.
Well, those industries in particular are going to be hit very hard by this continued lockdown. And what is particularly concerning for them is that a lot of the government support comes to an end or begins to taper off at the end of this month or in early July, which means that those that are not able to trade at full capacity are going to start seeing some costs creeping up unless the government steps in, unless the Chancellor steps in to alleviate the pain once again.
Sign that he's going to do that.
Well, there is huge pressure on him to act. If companies are forced to stay closed, because of course some companies cannot open at all under social distancing rules. Now we're told until July the 19th. It was going to be June the 21st. So these costs would have started coming back in once they'd started trading again. Now these costs are going to come in before they start trading again, or at least trading at full capacity. The Chancellor will come under pressure to help these companies through these, what we hope are the final weeks of lockdown. Of course, the even bigger fear is that these will not be the final weeks at all, and that we may get delay after delay after delay.
It would just be too depressing for words.
Well, indeed, the economy has started to open up, and these jobs figures show what happens when that happens in terms of the economy. Employment rising, unemployment falling. We've got redundancies now. The rate of redundancy is at the lowest level since before the pandemic struck. The rate of vacancies, people looking for jobs, at the highest level since the pandemic struck, which shows that companies, if they are allowed their freedoms, if they are allowed to trade, want to hire and want to get on.
Very interesting. That's Hugo Duncan, who is the Deputy Business Editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. GB News, the first new TV channel for news, led by ex-BBC star Andrew Neil, stuffed its established rivals like BBC and Sky in the ratings war when it was launched on Sunday night. However, during its first 24 hours, it experienced quite a few technical glitches and has been accused by some of failing to present the balanced reporting promised by Andrew Neil. The Mail's irrepressible Jan Moore has been watching and has written a hilarious review in today's paper. I love your description of Andrew Neil, Jan. His face, a pink fried egg looming through the gloom, his hair somehow corralled into a neat Weetabix of curls. And here's the point, his words hopelessly out of sync. They're still out of sync on day three.
I know. I mean, in many ways, this launch, it couldn't have been worse. You know, the sound was bad, the lighting was terrible, the sets are absolutely ghastly. It looks like it's been filmed on someone's handheld phone while they're in a moving car. I mean, I don't know why it's been quite so bad. But one would have hoped they would have resolved some of those issues by now. But hopefully yes, They'll be doing so soon.
I know, because you say we appear to be trapped in the receptions of the Crossroads Motel, which gives away you're an our age, Jan, before moving on to the chillax area of a suburban swingers club. And what about that odd sofa, which you quite rightly say looked like dung?
Oh, my God. I mean, where did they get it? It's like a 1970s design in some horrible tobacco-coloured sweatette that you sort of wipe clean with a wet cloth. I mean, of all the sofas in the world, why that one? It's got absolutely no redeeming features. I mean, maybe someone gave it to them for free or something. And everyone sits on it very awkwardly. I mean, Alistair Stewart the other day was practically horizontal, you know, stuck on the end of it. So I just really don't know why. I imagine they haven't got a very big budget. It's such a huge thing to launch a new, you know, an entire new television channel. But, you know, one would have thought they could do a little bit better.
Yeah, yeah. What of the talent, as we call it, Jan? I mean, nobody can dispute the formidable intellect and interviewing technique of Andrew Neil. But I was a bit surprised. I mean, Dan Wootton, who writes a column for us on Mail Online, I love your description of him. He appeared to have had 12 espressos and been charged into 1,000 electricity volts because he was so angry about everything.
I know, but I mean, I think it must be difficult to know on a brand new station, on a brand new show, it must be difficult to know where to pitch yourself. You know, how high do you go and how outraged do you have to be? You know, and Dan just seemed to be slightly three shades under hysterical. I mean, perhaps he'll calm down a little bit. I mean, comparing lockdown Britain to Singapore, where people get locked in jail for you know, throwing chewing gum on the street, seemed a little bit harsh to me. But, you know, he's trying to get the debate going and trying to make it all interesting. I'm sure he will calm down as the technical quality goes up.
There is a place for this station, after all. It's going to be anti-woke. We all cheer to that. Centre-right, I'm certainly happy with that. And the BBC, it has shot itself in the foot, Jan, so many times. And, of course, we don't have to pay for GB News, unlike the BBC licence.
Yeah. Well, what I feel is, I mean, despite all its faults and the technical issues, I really welcome it. I think it's an incredibly brave move. I also want to see a place on our televisions where someone can be a Daily Mail reader and think that Margaret Thatcher did more harm than good for this country and not be treated like a leper or a war criminal. You know, I'd like to see somewhere where Conservative cabinet ministers are spoken to with just a little bit of respect rather than being treated like, you know, I don't know, war criminals again. And hopefully this station will supply that.
I hope so, Jan. I say I watched it a bit today. I do think they've really badly got. Well, I was mesmerised by the fact that they were all out, that the voices were out of sync, and there were three or four women talking over each other, and the obligatory male at the end of the table trying to call order, and it just didn't really work.
No, I mean, I think the sort of, I mean, the breakfast show in particular just seems to be people babbling over each other.
Yes.
And I do think that in the morning, it's particularly grating. I mean, I think it was all right for when Piers Morgan was on Good Morning Britain, sort of bawling his head off. But when you've got sort of two or three voices trying to do the same thing, it just gets a little bit irritating. But as I say, I think things will calm down. And I think that if they can smooth out the technical issues, and I think if their backers can kind of keep their nerve, because it's not going to be an overnight success, but I do hope and believe that it will be a success.
On that, that's Jan Moyer on GB News. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.